Accession number 30018, reel 8.
So, Valley Reel 8. So, what was the kind of programme that you got into? Obviously, you were doing your ground school instruction in the morning. What other types of work were you involved in on the course?
Well, normally speaking, after the ground school lecture, most people would go down to the flights and they would then either get on with preparing their next test exercise sortie against some briefing they had been given previously, or they would arrive and be given a brief and they would then go and get their heads down. So the course is split into two halves, those that flew in the morning or those that flew in the afternoon, and you prepared or wrote reports in the other half, because there are only a certain number of airplanes and there were 32 of us or whatever on our course. Not sure that's the right number, but it was a day where you either did paperwork in terms of preparing for a test sortie, or you did the actual flying. Now, you were expected to produce what are called test cards. These are the cards that you take on your knee pad, which act as an aide memoir to what you must do next in the sortie. So it's a sequence of events, if you like, laid out on your card, with provision to write in the data that you got during the different events. And you each develop your own technique for how you make these flight test cards. Some people have got better memories for numbers and some people haven't, and you know, you've got to devise a system for reminding yourself of what to do and then what you've actually achieved. You've got to have some sort of recording process for that. And they were the basic skills that you were learning, as well as the handling techniques of, for example, since we've talked about takeoff and landing a lot, when you were asked to assess an aircraft's takeoff and landing characteristics, the landing characteristics were what happens if it lands heavy, what happens if it lands left wing low, what happens if it lands right wing low, or nose wheel first or tail wheel first according to the type and so on, what happens if it lands 10 knots fast, you know. In other words, you were expected to put the aircraft through a range of landings to suit the general requirements of accepting an aircraft's takeoff and landing characteristics. So you were trying, if you like, to represent squadron operators who would make mistakes. Would the aircraft tolerate the sort of mistakes that, in your view, pilots might make? And here, this big phrase kept cropping up, the standard service pilot, the normal service pilot. This was some mythical beast, you know, who was supposed to be not as good as you, and what was he capable of? Well, I never supported that notion. I always felt, right through my test flying career, that the standard service pilot, or the average service pilot, was better at flying his airplane than test pilots were. I always thought that, because the standard service pilot flew the same airplane day after day after day. And after 6 months of this, and sometimes the tour would be 2.5 or 3 years, they were so skilled at overcoming any deficiencies in the aircraft's design. A test pilot jumped into an airplane, flew it once or twice, and then he didn't fly it again for another 6 months. You know, I mean, your performance was poor by the standards of the squadron pilot who was flying the same airplane day in, day out. And I always did feel that. Now, to some extent, that was the result of me talking to test pilots when I was at Farnborough as a young lad. You can't ignore the influence that the RAE had on me as a young lad. It was tremendous. And I always had a great deal of respect for the standard service pilot. I can think of a couple of examples where The test pilots boobed badly. Let's go back to Cranwell. I was a jet province instructor pilot there. We had one aeroplane which, when we spun it, it did not like to recover. It had what was called a high rotation spin. It rotated faster and it went on longer after you put in the standard recovery. It was a rogue aeroplane as far as we were concerned. We said, we're not sending students solo spinning in this one. You know, and we didn't. And the instructors, you know, we used to talk about, you know. And anyhow, after a while, the boss said to me, I'm going to talk to Boscombe about this airplane because I think there's something wrong with it. It is so different from all the others. And he did. And one Friday afternoon, a couple of Boscombe test pilots came up to collect this airplane and take it away from us. And they were going to do some spinning trials that weekend. They didn't want to talk to us. They didn't want to ask us any questions. They didn't want any brief from us. They had been told that we thought it didn't spin as well, so they were just going to take it away. The boss phoned me up, and they did take it away. The boss phoned me up just before lunch and on the Saturday morning. He said they've jumped out of it. The first spin they got into was a high rotation spin. They weren't able to get out of it, so they bailed out. Now, that's the classic test pilot arrogance, you know, I'm not going to talk to the service pilots, I'm a better bloke than they are. Rubbish. You know, the service pilots have always got something to teach the test pilots. There was a similar situation in the Royal Navy with the Buccaneer. They had an aeroplane that, whenever they catapulted it, it put its nose up in the air and was very difficult to get the nose down, and it had to be trickled away, you know, and again they thought this one was worse than all the others, and so they asked the test pilots to come from Boscombe, you know, and again there was no discussion. There was all rubbish, you know. The test pilot punched out on the first launch because the nose came up, and that was that. So, you know, there have been, I'm afraid, over the years, some very bad blood between the Air Force and the test flying community. To some extent, this was the perception of the Royal Air Force pilots thinking that the test pilots were some, because they get yanked out of the Air Force and sent to a test pilot school, that they then become big heads and, you know, arrogant and what do they know about it sort of thing. And a few years later, when they've been away from the service doing their test flying bit for some years, they're completely out of date with what's going on the squadrons. And so I've always felt that this was a weakness in the test flying community. And indeed, when I became chief test pilot at Dunsfold, and so had a degree of say in how we went about our business at Dunsfold on the Harrier programme, I actually got senior RAF pilots from current Harrier squadrons to come down and fly the aeroplanes on our test programmes. In particular, things like the navigation exercise, where we were looking at a new navigation box and so on. Now, I got into terrible trouble with the establishment, with a big E, the test flying establishment, who were running Boscombe down as a test flying establishment. They were paying a lot of money to put their pilots through the NPAR test pilot school course on service pilots that got nothing to do with clearing and developing airplanes. Well, rubbish. We were looking at the second generation navigation system. I wanted blokes who were thoroughly used to the problems with the first generation one. Not some test pilot who had been showing the second generation box without ever seeing the first one. What do you think of that then, son? You know. So I got them, and I was you know, you have your mates and they tell you what's been going on behind your back, and I was told that conversations were going, what does Farley think he's doing? Trying to shut down ETPS, you know, all this sort of stuff. Well, I was a little bit ahead of my time, because now the establishment with the big E realises the importance of up-to-date squadron experience, as well as the specialist training of engineering test pilots the two things, both jobs need to be done. And so they have what are called joint test force teams now, made up of a mixture of service pilots and test pilots. And isn't that a better way of doing it, you see? But that's just common sense as far as I was concerned. But it took a while before the sort of test flying elite, in the early test flying elite, I suppose it was, not the present lot, they when they started formal test pilot training in the late 40s and so on, and people had this feeling that they were gods or something, and they weren't, you know. How I'm wandering off.
But it was important, obviously it sounds to me very important that that stage, what was occurring was a lack of information. They weren't asking for the information, neither was the information, right, in a sense forthcoming, yeah, yeah, to them, so they could make a proper assessment, although they were assessing.
Well, they just decided they were better than the average service pilot, so what do I want to talk to the average service pilot for? There was a degree of attitude like that. And that doesn't, that's not helpful at all.
Again, it seems it comes back to this idea of what the aeroplane is doing and the technical aspects and why it's not working properly, as opposed to the I can fly anything or that sort of thing, which you mentioned earlier. There's still that friction, isn't there, at that stage with
there can be, you know, it doesn't apply with all test pilots at all. I mean, it can't paint the whole lot with the same brush sort of thing. But there were a few test pilots around who didn't want to know about what squadron pilots view.
So when you were on the course, what types of aeroplanes were you testing as part of the course?
Well, we weren't testing them. We were being taught to test them. It's not semantics. Yes, we were doing all the tests that would have been done on those when they first flew, but we were being taught to do them in a structured way so that we learned how to do the tests. And the aircraft, we had a Piston Provost, Hunter, Canberra, Meteor, Viscount, Scimitar, I'm sure there are others, I can't think of them at the moment. So a wide range of types. Now, one of the important things, which is no longer the case in test pilot training in the 60s, was that the only way to give people adequate experience to go and do some brand new aeroplane was to give them experience of a wide range of types, because only that way could you learn all the good points and bad points of different aeroplanes, so that you could start to recognize these when you were faced with a brand new aeroplane. That may seem common sense, but I mean, how else can you learn other than by being very experienced in many different types of aeroplanes? This was how test pilots had tested aeroplanes in the 40s. They were the people that had accidentally, or just because of the way their careers turned out, they'd flown a wide range of types, and they hadn't killed themselves in the first 6 months. So they became competent to do it. Now, when test pilot training got formalised, they said, well, the only way to teach people all the different things, ways aeroplanes fly, is to put them in different types. Today, you have what's called a variable stability aeroplane. And a variable stability aeroplane is one where you can dial in different aircraft characteristics into the computer and then fly the aeroplane, and it will behave as if it's a totally different aeroplane. You can only fly it inside the envelope of the basic aircraft, of course. You can't make a variable stability aeroplane fly faster than the native aeroplane will. The Empire Test Pilot School has got a couple of Hawks that are variable stability aeroplanes now. And so a lot of the emphasis on the pilots needing to fly a wide range of types in order to experience a wide range of characteristics no longer applies. You can teach the characteristics in a variable stability aeroplane, you can teach the characteristics in modern flight simulators. Now, there's still some advantage to people actually having experience of several types, but the advantage is much smaller and is more to do with personal confidence and, you know, I've done it for real. I've actually flown an aeroplane that's like that. So they do still fly quite a few types. But the number of types available is much smaller now than it was when I was a young test pilot, student test pilot. So that the process has changed.
It's quite a range with the aircraft that you mentioned, though, from fighters all the way up to multi-engined aircraft, wasn't it?
Sure.
And were you actively encouraged to fly as many types as possible during that period to get that wide variety?
I suppose the answer is yes. I mean, we didn't... there was no way that we could go and fly more types than our instructors or tutors told us to, because, you know, we didn't say, oh, I've got an idea, can I go and fly so-and-so? No, it wasn't like that. No, but we were in... the course was organised such that you did fly a wide variety of types. I mean, the type that I haven't mentioned was Javelin, and I was given that for what was called my preview. Now, at the end of the course, when you've done all the exercises, you're sent off for one final exercise, and in this you are totally on your own. It's an aircraft you've never seen before. You are given no brief on it, nothing whatsoever, no information, nothing. You are just told to go to a hangar somewhere, it might be at another airfield, where they will be expecting you, and this aircraft's in the corner of the hangar. And you have then got to carry out four or five flights on it, and against your own plan, and then you're going to have to write a report about this, and you've got to assess the type in its operational role. I was given the Javelin in the all-weather fighter role, a role I wasn't familiar with because I had been a hunter day fighter role. So this was the sort of ultimate test. Now, it happens that my Javelin was in another hangar at Farnborough. It was on the south side of the airfield. And I went over there, and they were obviously, with hindsight, they were obviously briefed not to say anything to an ETBS student if he came to do a preview on one of their aeroplanes, other than respond to what he said. When you go and fly somebody else's aeroplane in a strange hangar, normally, you know, invite you in and have a cup of coffee, you know, what's this, what's that, do you want to see the so-and-so, or would you like me to check you out in the cockpit, or the ground crew will say that starting it's a bit tricky unless you do, you know, in other words, you would help the bloke convert to the aeroplane. And but this was an artificially stage-managed situation where I walked into the hangar and I said, I understand you've got Javelin XYZ, whatever. And they said, yes, that's right. And I said, is it serviceable? And they didn't reply. They just gave me the 700 to look at and make my own decision as to whether this paperwork was properly signed up and so on. And so I then asked if I could... sit in the cockpit if it was available and so on, and yes, and then eventually, you know, when I wanted it outside, I had to ask them if they put it outside, you know, type of thing. So it was a no help situation, and fine, that's what you have been trained to do. You have been trained for that job, and like all final exams, it was set up to be as realistic as possible. In fact, possibly, and I would argue certainly, harder than the bloke who went out to fly the first Javelin, Bill Waterton, because he would have been helped and briefed, like I was when I went out to fly the first Sea Harrier or whatever, you know. You're not totally on your own, but... so, yes, it was. That was an interesting exercise, and it was part of the philosophy of how you taught people to fly. Today, this preview is still done in exactly the same sort of fashion, but it's done in a syndicate, which is a game, in other words, is two, if not three pilots in the syndicate have got the same aeroplane, and it's like a joint test team arriving to do a job, you know? You're expected to have some of the skills necessary to work in a team and to allocate different aspects and then bring them all together with your results and the team debrief, PowerPoint, projector, the whole thing, you know, room full of people. You know, so things have got rather more realistic, I think, now, but the preview is still a very important thing. And so far as sending somebody to do a preview on the Harrier, which is what the Empire Test Pilot School has done now for some years, they have to do it on a two-seat Harrier, and there is a safety pilot goes along with them. They are expected to plan the sortie and execute the sortie without help, but they don't just give the guy a sort of 5 million or 10 or 20 or 30 million quid aeroplane these days and just hope it don't boob. I don't know what a Javelin cost, it wasn't that much, so, but anyhow.
What did you plan on the preview? What were the types of things that you were going to do?
Yes, now that's a very good question, because that is something else that has changed. On the course at ETPS, we were taught a variety of exercises, like stalling, spinning, lateral and directional control, asymmetric, takeoff, landing, instrument flight, you know, a range of topics. And each topic required a set of flights to be carried out to get all the data about that topic. And in particular, some of the topics were about stability and control, longitudinal stability and control, short period oscillations, long period oscillations, fugoids. In other words, there was a whole range of test manoeuvres that you had to put the aeroplane through, and then you wrote it all up. Now, when you came to do a preview, you were expected to allocate a certain amount of time in your four or five sorties to each of these things, because you were going to be expected to report on the whole raft of things you were taught at ETPS as it applied to this aeroplane. Now, I'd done autopilot on the Viscount. The Javelin didn't have an autopilot, so I hadn't got to do autopilot evaluation. But most of the other stuff, I can't think of anything else that... the Javelin was prohibited from spinning, so I couldn't do spinning. But most of the other tests were had to be stamped out. And so you had to write it. You had to write yourself test cards, and you had to go off and get the data. So I, you know, it was a very representative sort of test.
What was the Javelin like? Because obviously you'd worked with it on the preview. What was it like as an aircraft?
Well, I thought the handling qualities of it were really excellent after the Hunter. And, I mean, even to this day, people can't believe that I say that. Because the Hunter has a reputation of being a pilot's aeroplane, and the Javelin has a reputation of being an old woman's aeroplane. And, you know, that's forever it will be. But when I lifted off the ground at Farnborough on my first takeoff on that Javelin, halfway down the runway, I was amazed at how it felt. I was totally unprepared for how it felt, because my datum had been the Hunter. Now, the Hunter and the Javelin, they're both jet fighters. Okay, the Javelin's got two engines, the Hunter's got one. But they were both power controls. And it's power controls that create a result in a lot of the feel of an aeroplane. If it's not got power controls, it feels totally different. With power controls, it's very different. And the Hunter was a twitchy, unsteady aeroplane because of the power of its controls. So everybody waved goodbye when you got airborne for the first time. Lateral rocking. And it was quite touchy longitudinally, you know, the slightest an ounce or two on the stick, you know, and the nose would go up. I'm not saying it was difficult, I'm just saying that's the nature of the beast. When I got into the Javelin, as soon as it left the ground, it was rock steady. Absolutely rock steady. And I thought, whoa, why don't they all fly like this, you know? It was wonderful. It was something I had not experienced, a fully power-controlled aeroplane that was that steady. And I remember thinking straight away, well, this is what you want on a dark night when you're going into cloud, which is the role of the all-weather night fighter. So I was extremely impressed with it. Now, other people would say, yeah, but the Javelin was this and the Javelin was that, and they're talking about its operational capability, the fact it wouldn't do aerobatics, and, you know, and the Hunter was a great big, you know, exciting ship. So you have to be careful. If you are an objective test pilot, the Hunter has poor handling characteristics. That doesn't mean that people won't enjoy flying it, especially if they're slightly above average blokes and they can adapt to it and the other guy can't adapt, so that makes them an ace, doesn't it? You know, type of, you know, this competitive thing. But that's got no place, no part to play in my view, that sort of assessment in terms of engineering test flying.
Why were the restrictions on the Javelin? Because you mentioned it was stall prohibited and it couldn't do aerobatics then. Yeah. What was the reason behind
it? The aerodynamics of it had a severe limitation in that the aircraft could super stall. They lost several Javelins in spinning test accidents, and they lost several Javelins in stalling accidents in testing. And the requirement for the aeroplane as an aircraft and as a all-weather fighter and so on was so great in those days, in the mid-50s, early 60s, that it was accepted into service with these issues, and you were just told you do not do aerobatics, you know, because you might stall during the loop. You do not do spinning. All right, fine, you know, as I'm told, I'm in the Air Force. So the aircraft had limitations put on it in service. Today, such limitations would never be accepted. But, you know, it's half a century ago, and we had, if we were going to get an advance in some area, and the Javelin had a big fat radar in the nose, if we're going to get an advance in some area, then we were going to have to put up with problems in other areas. I mean, the Boeing's B-47 bomber that the United States Air Force had, their first swept-wing jet bomber, had appalling flying characteristics. But they put up with it. They put up with the accident rate. They put up with the specialist training needed. They put up with an elite B-47 piloting force that wasn't very flexible on a posting basis sort of thing, just because they needed this new capability. But today, well, it's what's called carefree handling is built into the flying control system of all aeroplanes, because the fly-by-wire, the Tornado, Javelin, dear, oh dear, Typhoon, these aeroplanes have what's called carefree handling, and they are literally pilot-proof in terms of a handling accident. You can't stall them, you can't spin them accidentally, because the flying control system will not yell at you. So the designers are better. The systems engineers are better today than they were. And these aeroplanes are a doddle to fly. If by fly you mean steer them through the sky. Go left, go right, go up, go down. Very demanding aeroplanes to operate as weapons of war. But that's a different story entirely.